So I took a, it was a little bit late to come here. I met some people. Chapter number 15, production is not refuted. You cannot irritate conventional phenomena by refuting them through investigating whether they are produced in one of four alternative ways. Objection. Madhyamika refutes production from self, from another, and from both, as well as causeless production. Does this refute production? If you claim that it does, then since these four alternative types of production do not exist even conventionally in this Madhyamika system, there is no need to add any qualifying phrase to the refutation of production. If you claim that it does not, then your refutation of the four alternatives of production fails to refute ultimate production. Reply, we do not accept the former of these two positions, so I will explain the answer to the latter. Those who assert ultimate production must accept that it withstands an analysis by reasoning that analyzes reality. As this is so, they must use reason to analyze production so as to discover which is among the four alternatives, production from self, other, and so forth. Hence, those who assert ultimate production are definitely required to assert that it can be analytically fixed within one of the four alternatives. Because we assert mere production, the arising of particular effects, independence on particular causes and conditions, we do not assert real production. Since we do not assert real production, why would we use reasoning that analyzes reality to analyze production as to which it is production from self, other, and so forth? As Chandrakirti's commentary on the middle way says, because things arise dependently, these mistaken conceptions cannot bear scrutiny. Therefore, the reasoning of dependent arising cuts all the entanglements of bad views. Therefore, Chandrakirti asserts that dependent production refutes the four alternative types of production. However, you claim that if there is no production from among the four alternative types, then even mere production does not exist. Hence, it seems that if you propose is the opposition of what Chandrakirti asserts. Chandrakirti's commentary on the middle way also says, because things are not produced causelessly or from causes such as a divine creator or from self, other, or both self and other, they produce dependently. However, according to you, it will be contradictory for Chandrakirti to say this. Therefore, dependently produced dependent arisings are free from four extreme types of production. So do not ask that which is free from extremes, which of the four extremes is it? Once again, these opponents go wrong by not distinguishing no intrinsic production from no production. How do you explain the statement in Chandrakirti's commentary on the middle way? The argument which shows that production from self and from other are untenable in the context of ultimate reality also shows that production is untenable even conventionally. This means that if you assert substantially existent production or production that exists by way of its intrinsic character, then those arguments are refuted even conventionally. It does not at all indicate a refutation of mere production, for in the transition to that passage says, the things that serve as the causes of afflicted and pure phenomena must produce substantially existent entities. If this were so, then the very words of your statement will not remain. Why? At this point, Chandrakirti gives a verse cited above. The argument which shows that production from self and other, commenting on that verse, he says, you must therefore admit, albeit unwillingly, that production by way of intrinsic character does not exist in terms of either of the two truths. Thus, insofar as essentially existent production is ultimate production, when others assert it, even if they assert it conventionally, you must refute its property just as you refute ultimate production. Since this is the excellent assertion of the Master Chandrakirti, you should not assert essentially existent production even conventionally. Chandrakirti's commentary on the middle way says, the self-generation of the sign of a barren woman exists neither in reality nor in the world. Similarly, all these things lack essential production, but for the world and in reality, both for the world and in reality. Some hold that the lack of interest in production, production's lack of interest in existence, must mean that production does not exist. They argue that dependent production and the absence of intrinsic production are contradictory. Chandrakirti says that those who say this have no errors or hurt. In saying that they have no errors, he means that they did not hear the qualification intrinsic. When we refer to the lack of intrinsic production, they hold that we have said lack of production. In saying that they have no heart, he means that even if they hear it, they have no comprehension of the meaning of the word intrinsic. Nagarjuna's 60 stanzas of reasoning says, the supreme knower of reality said that dependent origination is no production. Commenting on that passage, Chandrakriti's commentary on the 60 stanzas of reasoning says, when you see dependent arising, you do not perceive things as intrinsically existent. This is because the dependently produced is not intrinsically produced like a reflection. Is it not the case that dependently produced is only produced? How can you say that it is not produced? If you say that something is not produced, then how you should not say that it is dependently produced. Therefore, because these are mutually exclusive, your position is incorrect. Poor thing. With neither ears nor heart, you still argue. This put us in a difficult situation. We contend that dependently produced things are like reflections, not produced intrinsically, and this is the case. How can your objection stand a chance? Thus, you should cherish these distinctions. Also, the question of Naga King Anathavadabda says whatever is produced from conditions is not produced, it is not intrinsically produced. Whatever depends upon conditions, I consider empty. One who knows emptiness is diligent. After the Buddha stated it in the first line, whatever is produced from condition is not produced, he indicates with the second line, the manner of non-production. It is not intrinsically produced. Thus, adding a qualifying phrase to the object of negation, the Buddha says that things are not produced intrinsically. Some hear these words and do not understand them. They say only the produced is not produced, only the dependent does not depend. They evidently think that aggressively advocating this mass of contradictions constitute an advanced view. This is also stated very clearly in the Descent into Langa Sutra, as quoted by Chandrakriti in his clear words. Mahamati, thinking that they are not produced intrinsically, I said that all phenomena are not produced. This actually answers the question whether the qualification ultimately should be added to the refutation of production and so forth. However, I will answer this question more specifically below. On page number 190, Nagarjuna's fundamental treatise says, if there were the slightest trace which is non-empty, then a trace of emptiness will exist as well. As there is no trace that is not empty, how could there be a trace of emptiness? Therefore, because there is nothing that is not empty, the emptiness that is the absence of intrinsic existence also does not exist. Here in the fundamental treatise, empty and non-empty refer to being empty and not empty of intrinsic nature, and they are used in this way throughout the entire text, from beginning to the end. Thus, not empty of intrinsic nature means having intrinsic nature. What could be more ridiculous than your position that since there is no intrinsic nature, the emptiness, that is the absence of intrinsic nature, also does not exist? Furthermore, the definite knowledge which apprehends that something such as a seedling lacks essential or intrinsic nature apprehends that there is no intrinsic nature in the seedling. It does not think that this absence of intrinsic nature exists, nor does it think that this absence of intrinsic nature does not exist. Close your eyes, turn inward, and know this. It is very easy to understand. It would not be appropriate to apprehend the absence of intrinsic nature as existing in that way. Suppose that these that mean that it is proper to use reason to refute the existence of emptiness in order to overcome the conception that the absence of intrinsic nature exists. You will still have to hold that you are refuting the object of some other mind, which apprehends the absence of intrinsic nature as something that exists. It will be quite wrong to refute the object of wisdom that realizes that a seedling does not intrinsically exist. When we refute the essential or intrinsic nature of a seedling, we have definite knowledge that the seedling does not intrinsically exist. Then when some other awareness apprehends the absence of intrinsic nature as existing, reason does not refute the object of that other mind. However, if that mind holds that emptiness exists essentially, then reason does refute that. Two paragraphs below, Aryadeva's 400 stanza says, as there is nothing that is not empty, from what can emptiness arise? If there is nothing to oppose, how can there be a remedy? If you disagree, then you refute the existence of the emptiness, which is the absence of intrinsic nature. Then the absence of intrinsic nature will not exist. In that case, since essential or intrinsic nature will exist, it will be totally inappropriate to refute intrinsic nature. For in this vein, Nagarjuna's refutation objection says, how could the absence of intrinsic nature in my words refute my claim that things lack intrinsic nature? If the absence of intrinsic nature were refuted, then the presence of intrinsic nature would be proven. And Nagarjuna's commentary on the refutation of objections, commenting on that, says very clearly, just as someone might stop sound with a sound, don't make a sound. So the absence of intrinsic existence in your vote refutes your claim that there is no intrinsic nature in things. The example is correct, but your point is not. Here, words that have no intrinsic nature do refute the intrinsic existence of things. If the absence of intrinsic nature in words could refute the absence of intrinsic nature in things, then this would refute the absence of intrinsic nature itself. Therefore, things would have intrinsic nature, and because of having intrinsic nature, they would not be empty. Therefore, just after the passage in Fundamental Treatise cited above, how could there be a trace of emptiness? Nagarjuna says, the conqueror said that emptiness eradicates all dogmatic views. As for those who take a dogmatic view of emptiness, he said that they are incurable. Again, having a dogmatic view of emptiness does not mean taking the view that things are empty of intrinsic nature. It means thinking of emptiness of intrinsic nature, as truly existent, or viewing it as a real thing. For Buddha Pali's commentary on the Fundamental Treatise says this very clearly, giving an example, it is possible to overcome the misconceptions of those who think that things exist essentially. You can explain emptiness and show them that things are empty of essence, saying, as these are dependent arisings, they are designated. As this or that thing, through the force of causes and conditions, things do not exist essentially. However, there is no way to overcome the misconceptions of those who think that emptiness is a real thing. For example, if you tell someone, I have nothing, and that person then says, give me that nothing, how could you make that person understand that you have nothing? If it is not taken in this way, the example would also be inappropriate. Suppose you say to me, give me some money, and I reply, I have no money. If you conclude that person has no money, then there is no problem. However, if you think of no money as a kind of money, then there is no way that I can assure you that I have no money. In just the same way, I suppose you ask, do things have intrinsic nature or not? And I say, they do not have intrinsic nature. If you then think things do not have intrinsic nature, how could that be a problem? I wanted you to get this idea. However, if you think that things a lack of intrinsic nature is itself intrinsically existent, then this is a problem. According to your interpretation, when you hear me say that I have no money and then develop the idea, this person has no money, then even that idea must be refuted. So it will be wonderful for you to rely on what I have said. Also, in the clear words, Chandrakriti speaks of clinging to emptiness as a real thing, hence he is not refuting emptiness itself, and there is no fault in simply having the view of emptiness. The verse summary of the perfection of wisdom in 8,000 lines says, a bodhisattva who thinks like grids are empty is meditating on science and lacks faith in the realm of non-production. Also, Nagarjuna's precious garland says, therefore, the great sage refuted views of self and selflessness. Although these and other scriptures and treatises say that it is wrong to have a view of emptiness or selflessness, you should understand them as I have explained to you above. Otherwise, they will contradict a great many statements in other texts. In the Heart Sutra, Shariputra asks Avalokiteshvara how one who wishes to practice the profound perfection of wisdom should train. In reply, Avalokiteshvara says the bodhisattva should correctly view these five aggregates as empty of intrinsic existence. The verse summary of the perfection of wisdom in 8,000 lines says, one who knows that phenomena do not intrinsically exist is practicing the supreme perfection of wisdom. Chandrakriti's commentary on the middle way says, consequently, a yogi views the emptiness of the self and that which belongs to the self and thereby becomes free. Therefore, the root of all problems is ignorance that superimposes intrinsic existence. There is only one consciousness that can uproot it by apprehending things in a way that explicitly contradicts it. That consciousness is the wisdom that knows selflessness, the absence of intrinsic existence. As this is so, if you refute this way of apprehending things, then you will have to admit, albeit unwillingly, that you are refuting the way of reality. At the point where Aryadeva's 400 stanza says there is no second door to peace, Chandrakriti's commentary on the 400 stanza says the extinction of the attachment is the cause of attaining Nirvana. And except for the view of the absence of intrinsic existence, there is no other teaching that can cause that extinction of attachment. The selflessness characterized by the absence of intrinsic existence is the one and only door to peace. As a gateway to the city of Nirvana, it is alone and nothing can match it. Although there are three doors of liberation called emptiness, signlessness, and richnessness, still only the view of selflessness takes priority. If you know phenomena without exception as selfless and thereby extinguish every attachment to all things, then how could you ever long for anything or apprehend signs in anything? Because of this, selflessness alone is the one and only door to peace. Therefore, the equipment for enlightenment explains, because phenomena do not intrinsically exist, they are empty. Further, because phenomena are empty, what use are signs? In as much as they have overcome all signs, why would the learned wish for such phenomena? Thus, Chandrakriti clears up the apparent contradiction between scriptural explanations that there are three doors to liberation and other texts, which explain that the way of emptiness of intrinsic existence is the only door to liberation. He uses scripture and reason to prove that just this view is the door to liberation. Why should the mere negation of intrinsic nature imply the refutation of the object of wisdom? He should not, for such knowledge, remedies the conception of the two selves as signs, unless even a trace of such a misconception. If you refute as defective even such a conception and refute all conceptuality of any sort, good or bad, then it is evident that you want to set up the system of Chinese about Hashang. We are on page number 197, chapter number 16, Non-Negating Enough. Page number 196, the last paragraph. Thus, when making the philosophical determinations, make your principal task to determine that an object as conceived by innate ignorance does not exist. Ancillary to that, refute objects of accurate misconceptions. If you do not understand this and fail to eradicate the perspectives of innate ignorance, then when you refute your personal self, you will only refute a self that is permanent, unitary, and independent. When you refute an objective self, you will only refute things that are imputed by the advocates of philosophical tenets, such as objects that are partless particles, partless moments of experience, or a natural substrate. With three gunas asserted by the Samkhyas, this is completely inappropriate. If you think otherwise, then when you make philosophical determinations, you will establish nothing more than this shallow selflessness. As philosophical determinations are made for the purposes of meditation, when you meditate, you will have to meditate only on this. Therefore, even if you actualize such a selflessness in meditation and consummate your cultivation of it, nothing would come of it. It will be extremely absurd to claim that you can overcome innate afflictions by seeing as non-existent the two selves imputed by acquired misconceptions. Chandrakriti's commentary on the middle way says, when knowing selflessness, some eliminate a permanent self, but we do not consider this the basis of the conception of I. It is therefore astonishing to claim that knowing the selflessness expunges and uproots the view of self. As Chandrakriti's explanation of the middle way commentary says, to elucidate this very point, the irrelevance of such to innate afflictions by way of an example. Someone sees a snake living in the wall of his house. To ace his concern, someone else said, there is no elephant here. Alas, to others it is ridiculous to suppose that this will dispel the fear of snake. Chandrakriti refers to the selflessness of the person, but it is the same for the selflessness of the objects, he could have added. When knowing selflessness, some elimination can occur conception of self, but we do not consider this the basis of ignorance. It is therefore astonishing to claim that knowing the selflessness expunges and averts ignorance. In the statement by Nagarjuna set forth above, he says that defining characteristics of a nature and not being fabricated and not depending upon something else, was he speaking hypothetically or does such a nature exist? The Buddha proceeds a nature saying, this is a reality of phenomena. It is not fabricated and does not depend on something else. Chandrakriti's explanation of the middle way commentary establishes that it exists, citing a sutra source. Yes. Is there a nature that is such qualification as the Master Nagarjuna claims? Yes, it is the reality of which the Bhagavan spoke extensively, saying, whether Tathagatas appear or not, the reality of phenomena remains. What is this reality? It is the nature of things such as these eyes. And what is their nature? We are on page number 199, second paragraph. Accordingly, compounded phenomena such as eyes are not natures in the sense of being essentially existence, nor are they natures when reality is preceded at the final nature. So they are neither sort of nature. Ultimate truths are natures when reality is preceded as the final nature. But what established them as such nature is that they are non-fabricated and do not depend upon something else. They do not at all exist as natures in the essence of being essentially existent. Thus, they exist merely conventionally. Fabricated means produced in the sense of a new occurrence of something that did not exist before, and depend upon something else means to depend on causes and conditions. Since forms and so forth are neither type of nature, when you speak of cultivating the path in order to view the final nature, nature is the sense of reality. Therefore, Chandrakriti says that pure contact is not senseless. Moreover, he explains that his utter lack of an assertion that phenomena have a nature in the sense of essential existence does not contradict his incidental assertion of a final nature. Chandrakriti's explanation of the middle way commentary says, alas, utterly wrong. You do not assert real things at all, but also incidentally assert a nature that is non-fabricated and does not depend upon something else. You are saying things that are blatantly contradictory. In saying this, you miss the point of fundamental treatise. This is what it means. If eyes and such dependent arisings that are evident to ordinary childish beings were their own nature, then pure content will be senseless, because even inaccurate consciousnesses would know that nature because they are not their own nature. Pure content, for the sake of viewing that nature, does have a purpose. Further, I say that this nature, as compared to conventional truths, is non-fabricated and does not depend upon something else. Only something that ordinary childish beings do not see is suitable to be nature. Therefore, the ultimate is neither a thing nor a non-thing. By nature, it is simply peace. Here, thing and non-thing refers to essential existence and other non-existence, as explained above in the section on dualism. Such as form, in page number 200, in the second paragraph, such as form, there serves a substrata. This is also explained by Lama Tsongkhapa in the commentary to Fundamentals of Wisdom. Thus, it is not contradictory for both substrata and attribute to be objects of a single mind. Since you have non-stop dualistic appearance, that emptiness is a nominal rather than actual ultimate truth. By accustoming yourself to that view, which knows the absence of intrinsic nature, you will know it by perceiving it. For such a consciousness, all mistaken appearances stop. Mistaken appearances here means the appearance of intrinsic existence, where this is no intrinsic existence. Therefore, since the consciousness is directly perceiving, that reality does not perceive substrata, such as forms, neither that reality nor its substrata exist from perspective of that mind, so emptiness and forms, etc., must be posited as reality and substrata from the perspective of some other mind, a conventional mind. As this is so, an ultimate truth is posited where, in addition to the stilling of all elaborations of essential existence, there is also a sheer stoppage of all elaborations of mistaken appearances. Appearance of intrinsic existence where there is none. Thus, while we assert a final nature, how could we be forced to accept an essentially existent nature? Chandrakriti's clear words say, driven by the impairment of ignorance, ordinary beings perceive a certain aspect in things. As noble beings who are free from the impairment of ignorance do not see that mistaken aspect, there is something else that serves as its object. That very entity is posited as the final nature of those things. Also, things lack of intrinsically existent production is not anything. Thus, since it is just a non-thing, it is no essence. Therefore, it is not the intrinsic nature of things. On page number 201, Some Tibetans do not posit ultimate truth as a sheer elimination of the illusion of the object of negation, for example, the two selves. Instead, they hold that as the object of a mind that non-mistakenly know how things exist, the ultimate appears to exist under its own power, just as things such as blue and yellow appear to an ordinary mind. Ascertaining that it does exist in that way is a view that knows the profound. They also claim that it is a misstep with regard to the correct view to regard external and internal phenomena, the basis with regard to which living beings cling to the true self as lacking intrinsic existence. Last paragraph, to avoid missteps in reaching the mathematical review, it is most crucial to refute wrong ideas about the object of negation. For that reason, I have given an extended explanation. Chapter number 17, the actual object to be negated, page number 202. How our systems identifies the object of negation. This is three parts. The actual identification of the object to be negated. In general, with regard to the objects of negation, there are objects negated by path and objects negated by reason. As to the first of these, material separation of the middle from the extreme says, there are teachings on afflicted obscuration and on cognitive obscuration. We hold that all obscurations are among this, and when they are gone, you are free. Thus, there are afflicted obscurations and the cognitive obscurations. These objects of negation do occur among objects of knowledge, for if they do not exist, then all embodied beings will escape cyclic existence without assertion. As for objects negated by reason, Nagarjuna's refutation of objection says, someone thinks that an emanated woman is a woman. Another emanation stops this wrong conception. This is like that. In his commentary on the refutation object, he says, a woman emanated by some being is empty of the nature of being a woman, but someone else wrongly thinks this is ultimately a woman. Therefore, due to that wrong conception, attachment arises. The Tathagata or a Saraka of the Tathagata emanates another emanation and thereby stops that person's wrong conception. Similarly, my words, which are empty like an emanation, stop any apprehension that anything exists intrinsically. Any things like the emanated woman are empty and do not intrinsically exist. Thus, he speaks of misconception as objects of negation, and he also treats the intrinsic nature that they apprehend as an object of negation, making two kinds of object to be negated. However, the primary object of negation is the latter. For in order to stop an inaccurate consciousness, you must first refute the object which that consciousness apprehends. For instance, dependent arising refutes the essential or intrinsic existence of persons and phenomena. This latter object of negation cannot be among objects of knowledge because if it did exist, then it could not be refuted. Still, there are mistaken superimpositions that apprehend its existence, so you must refute it. This refutation is not like destroying a pot with a hammer, rather. It is a matter of developing certain knowledge that recognizes the non-existent as non-existent. When you develop certain knowledge that it does not exist, the mistaken consciousness that apprehends it as existing will stop. Similarly, using reason to establish something is not a matter of newly establishing something that did not exist before, like a seed producing a seedling. Rather, it is the development of certain knowledge that recognizes a phenomenon as it is. Nagarjuna's refutation of objects is, what do you use it to establish the negation of what does not exist anywhere, even without words? Page number 205, second paragraph. For example, even though Devadatta is not in the house, someone says Devadatta is in the house. Someone else, in order to show that Devadatta is not there, says Devadatta is not there. These words do not cause Devadatta not to be there, but merely indicate that Devadatta is not in the house. Similarly, the words things like intrinsic nature do not cause things like intrinsic nature. All things like intrinsic nature, like creatures in a magical illusion. However, childish beings are confused about the absence of real essence in all things. So we make them understand that there is no intrinsic nature in the things that they confuse by ignorance, verify as having intrinsic nature. Therefore, what you have said that if there is no intrinsic nature, what use are the words? There is no intrinsic existence in as much as things will be established without intrinsic nature, even without any words, without saying anything is not reasonable. You should understand this in accordance with this very clear statement. Some hold that to conduct extensive rational analysis required for refutations, and proves instrumental among mere conventional words, for all phenomena are devoid of refutation and proof in that if something exists, it cannot be refuted, and if it does not exist, it need not be refuted. This is a nonsensical collection of contradictions, showing neither general awareness of how reason establishes and negates things, nor general awareness of how the path establishes and negates things. For you claim that refutation and proof should not be done when you yourself are refuting your opponent's use of analysis that involves refutation and proof, citing as your reason. If something exists, it cannot be refuted, and if it does not exist, it need not be refuted. Furthermore, your stated reasons does not exist, it need not be refuted. Your stated reason is not an appropriate refutation of an opponent who holds that it is necessary to conduct refutation and proof because according to you, if something exists, it cannot be refuted. And if it does not exist, it need not be refuted. We carry out refutations with excellent reasoning so as to stop inaccurate and mistaken conceptions. Proof by reasoning is a technique for developing accurate and certain knowledge. Therefore, those who wish to stop the various inaccurate awarenesses and to develop the various accurate awarenesses should pursue the collections of arguments by authors such as Nagarjuna and should develop minds that have accurate and certain knowledge of refutation and proof. If, as you say, refutation by means of reasoning is done in order to develop accurate and certain knowledge by eradicating inaccurate cognitive processes, then this reason will cancel out an object as it is apprehended by a certain kind of mind. What is that mind? In general, there are a limitless number of conceptual consciousnesses that apprehend the object of negation. However, you should carefully identify the incorrect conceptual consciousnesses that is the root of all faults and defects, and you should eradicate its referent object. So, His Holiness comments that the very subtle form of the afflicted emotions, and so for those afflicted emotions, the object that they perceive or appears to them, so it apprehends the internal and external phenomena as existing by their own intrinsic character. So, in this way, the subtle form of afflicted emotions, when they perceive some physical phenomena or their own focal objects, so they act as being subtle by themselves. In page number 206, the last paragraph, what is this delusion like? It is ignorance, which in this context is an awareness that mistakenly superimposes intrinsic nature. It apprehends internal and external phenomena as existing by way of their own intrinsic character. Chandrakriti's commentary on 400 stanzas says, it is said that one becomes attached to the things by the power of an afflicted misunderstanding, a consciousness that superimposes an essence of things, and that one stops silly existence by totally stopping that which serves as the seed for the process of silly existence. In order to eradicate this, the 400 says, the seed of all existence is a consciousness, objects are its sphere of activity. When you see that object like self, you negate the seed of all existence. The second stanza, this is also called the conception of true existence, for Aryadeva's 400 says, just as the tactile sensory faculty pervades the body, delusion lies within all the afflictions. Therefore, by destroying the delusion, you will destroy all afflictions. Commenting on this verse, Chandrakriti's commentary on the 400 stanza says, because of confusion brought on by the thought that things truly exist as they appear, delusions act to superimpose upon things as essence of true existence. If, as you say, ignorance is the root of cyclic existence, then it will be incorrect for Chandrakriti to explain in the commentary on the middle way and in the clear words that the view of perishing aggregates as I and mine is the root of cyclic existence, for there cannot be two primary causes of cyclic existence. In the section on the person of medium capacity, I've already explained what other masters say about how to assert ignorance and the view of perishing aggregates. Therefore, here I will explain the assertions of the chapter, Chandrakriti. Other mathematicians consider the conception of things as truly existent to be a cognitive obscuration. He asserts that such a conception is ignorance, and what is more, he asserts that it is afflicted ignorance. Page number 208. For as cited above, his commentary on the 400 stanzas explains that conception of true existence is afflicted. Also, his explanation of the middle way commentary says, because this causes lame beings to be confused in their view of the actual state of things, it is delusion. Ignorance mistakenly superimposes upon things as essence that they do not have. It is constituted so as to block perception of their nature. It is a concealer. Also, thus conventional truths are posited through the force of afflicted ignorance, which is included within the factors of cyclic existence. That's because he explains that it is the first of the 12 factors of dependent arising. It is an affliction and not a cognitive obscuration. What are the cognitive obscurations? This will be explained below. We are on page number 209. 70 stanzas on emptiness says, the teacher said that ignorance is the conception that in reality things are produced from causes and conditions. From this the 12 factors arise. Through seeing reality, you know that things are empty. Ignorance does not arise. This is the cessation of ignorance. Because of this the 12 factors cease. Also, the 26th chapter of his fundamental treatise says, when ignorance is stopped, compositional activity will not arise at all. That which stops ignorance is knowing and meditating on reality. By stopping this and that earlier factor of dependent arising, this and that later factor will not arise. In this way, you thoroughly stopped the whole mass of suffering. This and the other passages cited are in agreement and fit together very well with the line in Nagarjuna's precious garland, as long as you conceive of the aggregates, which says that the root of cyclic existence is a misconception, is the conception of the aggregates as intrinsically existent. The noble Aryadeva also asserts that, as is clearly indicated by the passage cited earlier, just as that tactile sensory faculty pervades the body and also the root of the cyclic existence is a consciousness. When the Master Nagarjuna refutes the object of negation in the fundamental treatise, he gives all of his diverse arguments so as to refute an intrinsic nature. Delusion's refutation of phenomena as essentially existent and to show that phenomena lack essence. Thus, Nagarjuna gives a wide range of arguments only for the sake of eradicating the way that ignorance apprehends things. Buddha Balida's commentary on the fundamental treatise says, what is the purpose of teaching Tibetan arising? The Master Nagarjuna, whose very nature is compassion, so that living beings are beset by various sufferings and assume the task of teaching the reality of things, just as it is so that they might be free. He therefore began teaching Tibetan arising, for it is said, since what is not real, you are bound. Seeing the real, you are free. What is the reality of things just as it is? It is the absence of essence. Unskilled persons whose eye of intelligence is obscured by the darkness of delusion conceive of an essence in things and then generate attachment and hostility with regard to them. When the illumination of the knowledge of Tibetan arising clears away the darkness of delusion and the eye of wisdom sees the absence of essence in things, then there is no foundation for the other afflictions, and attachment and hostility do not develop. Second last paragraph, page number 210. Arya Deva's 400 stanzas says, conceptuality ceases and you are bound. It should be stopped here. Even the conceptuality mentioned in that statement does not refer to all conceptual consciousnesses whatsoever, but refer to conceptual consciousnesses that superimpose essential existence on phenomena. For commenting on that passage, Chandrakriti's commentary on the 400 stanzas says, a conceptual consciousness superimposes an incorrect sense of intrinsic existence. Further, he asserts that it is afflicted ignorance. Hence, while there are those who claim that reason refutes the object of every conceptual consciousness that thinks this is such and such, they have done no detailed investigation of this matter. So if somebody is sleeping, I will awake you. I think it is due to the air conditioned. There seems to be, my nose seems to be running. Tea offering. The tea offering is for Charisik. The Charisik, our Avalokiteshvara with 1,000 arms and 1,000 eyes. And who is the king of all the world? And the one who teaches and shows the path to anyone according to one's necessities. I offer my tea to you.
So here today, many upholders of the Vinaya, the monastics from different monasteries, including the three great learnings of centers of learning. So with regard to Vinaya, there is a very pure tradition of the Theravada tradition. And also we have the Tibetan Buddhist Vinaya tradition of the Mulasarasvastivada school, a very pure lineage. So in the past, we didn't have much interaction with them. And the people from the Pali tradition say that the Tibetans do not have Vinaya practice, but it is becoming clearer and clearer that we have, to them, that we have Vinaya practice. So since some time ago, Gadenchen Rinpoche and I had some discussion which we didn't have with others. So with regard to the Vesak, for example, there is a difference of 1 month between the Theravada tradition and our tradition in celebrating the Buddha's the full moon day, the Vesak full moon day, which happens according to the Tibetan calendar. What the Theravadins actually celebrate, according to the Tibetan month, it falls in the third month. So if we could have a Vinaya practice, which could be same to all the traditions, Tibetan and the Theravada traditions. And we should also, of course, find a very clear source in the Indian classic text on Vinaya, such as texts written by Guna Prabha. And then there are some differences in the number of counting number of days between the Theravada and Tibetan Vinaya tradition. And so this time we have the Gaden Tirumbuche and then the teachers of the seeds of learning who are gathered here. I thought if you could have some discussion about this, you don't need to come to some conclusion as such, but I thought it would be good to have some discussion. In January next year, there is an international conference on Vinaya. There is a plan for this. I don't know how many people will actually participate in it. So we may have discussions on the Vinaya there. So today we don't have time, but tomorrow also we don't have time. But on the 10th, we'll have a celebratory function in the morning, and then in the afternoon, as I visit the different places, it would be good if you could gather all the Vinaya upholders of Vinaya, could gather and have discussions. So please keep this in mind. So many of these practices, of course, we say that we have, and this is our tradition or our practice, but we don't try to find the sources in classic texts. And when people ask us, we are not able to explain well, except that saying that this is our tradition, this is how we practice, and so it's not good just to remain there. We're on page 211. So, this is finished. And for Arya Deva's 400 Sansa says, seeing what is not emptiness. No, the 400 Arya Deva Sansa says, conceptually, this cease and you are bound. It should be stopped here. Even the conceptuality mentioned in that statement does not refer to all conceptual consciousness whatsoever, but rather to conceptual consciousness that superimposes essential existence on phenomena. For commenting on that passage, Chandragupta's commentary on the 400 stanzas say, a conceptual consciousness superimposes an incorrect sense of intrinsic existence. Further, he asserts that it is afflictive ignorance. Hence, while there are those who claim that reason refutes the... every conceptual consciousness that thinks this is such and such, they have done no detailed investigation of this. If it were otherwise, then since for ordinary beings the meaning of reality is hidden, they would have no way of apprehending the meaning of emptiness without... So the realists of our own tradition and page 211, after the one verse from four stanzas. It is based on this intrinsic nature, the referent object of the way that ignorance apprehends things as explained above. It shouldn't essentially, Buddhist and non-Buddhist, reify many different things. When you negate the referent of ignorance as a cognitive process, you completely stop all of these tenet-driven reifications as though you cut a tree at its roots. Therefore, those who have the faculty of wisdom should understand that the referent object of innate ignorance is the basic object of negation and should not devote themselves merely to refuting imaginary constructs that are imputed only by the advocates of philosophical tenets. Refuting the object of negation in this way is not an idle pursuit. You see that living beings are bound in cyclic existence by a wrong conceptual consciousness that has the object of negation as its object, and you then refute its object. What binds? So hence the ultimate wrong conceptual consciousness that conceives the object of negation is the innate ignorance, which is the first of 12 factors of dependent arising. Acquired objects of negation are merely superimpositions based on it. Thus, it is not at all the case that reason negates all of the cognitive processes through which non-conceptual consciousness sensory apprehends things. Therefore, so as I explained earlier, this is clearly mentioned, it would be clear after having studied the Madhyamaka text, then when you look at things at the outside world and the monks and nuns, when you look at things, there is this appearance that they exist independently from our own conception. And so that means there is this appearance of the true existence, which is the object of negation to our sensory consciousnesses. And when you look at me, you see the Dalai Lama as if I exist from my own objectively. And so there is, for you too, there is an appearance of this object of negation to your sensory consciousness. Of course, all appearances to this sensory consciousness doesn't have to be the true existence. And then because of this appearance, then when we actually cling onto it, then there is the arisal of this clinging to the true existence. The seventh Dalai Lama says, all these phenomena in nirvana, samsara and nirvana are designated by our mind. And this mind in turn is empty. And therefore, how wondrous this nature, the way of the mode of existence of this mind. So in one of a response to a letter by the seventh Dalai Lama, he writes, to the consciousness of dreaming, dream, there is appearance of the horse and elephant and so forth. And self and others and samsara and nirvana. So whatever appears to your mind, they appear to have to exist from the basis of designation of objects. So all phenomena, so things appear through, things exist through our naming consciousness and our conceptions and our language. Except that there is no way we can actually posit things existence of things. So although this is the way things are regarding how things exist, yet because of being sullied by, covered by thick, dense ignorance of ignorance, sleep of ignorance to the ordinary being. This is how things appear, is that they have some objective existence. But you can confirm that things do not have such a way of existence. So for all of us, our experiences of pain and pleasure appear to have some objective existence. If it were the case that they have such an existence, then when we search for them, they should become clearer and clearer, but they do not. And therefore, the fact that things exist, these experiences exist, is confirmed by our experience. So we can decide that these experiences exist, but when we search for them within the aggregates, the basis of designation, we don't find them. What appears to our mind is that things, what do not appear to our mind is that the things are not designated. But when we are able to confirm that there is no such way, that things do not have such a way of existence, objective existence, and therefore, when that happens, when you confirm to your mind, the mind which perceives emptiness, actually, in the view of that, then all the appearances also disappear. Just as the seventh Dalai Lama has said, in autumn or fall season, all the clouds disappear within this empty sphere of this space. Likewise, when emptiness is cognized, then all these different multitudes of things also disappear. So I see this illusory spectacle for me, a yogi of who sees things as having no intrinsic existence. So these undeceptive conventionalities of things appear to me a spectacle, and to me, the yogi, he says. So His Holiness is commenting on this reply on page 212. So however, here in this case, the reification by ignorance there is with regard to the object, be they persons or phenomena, a conception that those phenomena have ontological status, a way of existing in and of themselves without being posited through the force of an awareness. The referent object that is thus apprehended by that ignorant conception, the independent ontological status of those phenomena, is identified as a hypothetical self or intrinsic nature. And then the quotations. Thus, he says that those are synonyms. Without depending on other does not mean not depending on cause and conditions. Instead, other refers to subject, that is a conventional consciousness, and something is said not to depend on another due to not being posited through the force of that conventional consciousness. Therefore, autonomously refers to the nature of an object that has its own unique ontological status or manner of being. It is just this that is called essence or intrinsic nature. Take, for example, the case of an imaginary snake that is mistakenly ascribed to a rope. If we leave aside how it is ascribed from the perspective that apprehends error, so the conventional mere appearance of which is in convention,
Tanya
So the commentary, Chandragiri's commentary on 400 senses say, thus, Chandragiri states how phenomena do not exist, essentially exist. Therefore, what exists objectively in terms of its own essence without any posited, without being posited through the power of a subjective mind is called a self. So if there were to be a thing which is not designated or labeled by our mind and name and concepts, then this would be the case. The absence of this quality is in the person is called the selflessness of persons. If its absence in phenomena such as eyes, ears, and so forth is called the selflessness of objects, hence one may implicitly understand that the conceptions of that intrinsic nature as present in persons and objects are the conceptions of two selves. It is as Chandragiri's commentary on 400 stanzas say. The conception of persons as existing quam, page 213. The conception of persons as existing by way of their intrinsic character cannot be a conception of a personal self, for if it were, then even observing persons other than oneself and conceiving of them as existing by way of their own intrinsic character would be a conception of a personal self. If you admit this, then while it must be a view of the perishing aggregate, it cannot be a view of the perishing aggregate insofar as it is not a conception that thinks I reply. As explained earlier, Chandragiri says that an intrinsic nature in person is a self of a person, so one must accept that not conception of the... So the mere I becomes the object. So when you think about an I, so, and there is this conception of this I having some kind of an intrinsic existence or essential existence, that is the grasping at the perishable aggregates, the view of perishable aggregates. There's a person other than another person of another continuum of mental and physical aggregates is not the object of observation. With regard to how that object of observation is apprehended, Chandragiri's explanation of Madhyamaka Avatara says, concerning that, a view of the perishing aggregates operates within the thoughts of I and mine. Thus, it is not simply a conception of intrinsic existence, that is, existence by way of intrinsic character, it must be a conception thinking I. The explanation of the middle way commentary also says, just the view of the perishing aggregates is to be eliminated, and it is eliminated upon understanding selflessness of the self. Thus, Chandragiri says that you eliminate the view of perishing aggregates by knowing the selflessness, the non-intrinsic existence of the self, that is, its object of observation, thereby contradicting the way that it is apprehended by the view of perishing aggregates. Hence, the view of the perishing aggregates must apprehend the opposite of that wisdom which knows selflessness. Moreover, since a view of perishing aggregates is a conception of the person as essentially existent, it is a conception of an I that exists by way of its intrinsic character. Using this as an example, you should be able to understand the view of perishing aggregates, that is the conception of mine. Even now, when you do conceive I or mine, conceptions of the person as substantially existent are still cases of ignorance that misconceives itself a person, so it is not the case they are not afflictions. Next topic, when to add qualifications to other objects of negation. When you say that utter non-existence, such as the horns of a rabbit and the sons of a barren woman do not exist, you need not attach a qualification such as intrinsically. Similarly, there are things that although existent among objects of knowledge, exist at some times and places and do not exist at other times and places. When you say that these do not exist at a particular time or place, there is also no need to add that qualification. Furthermore, when refuting imaginary constructs from the unique assertions of the Buddhist and non-Buddhist essentialists, things that Madhyamakas do not accept as conventionally existent, there is no need to newly attach the qualification essentially or intrinsically to the objects, except in the occasional situation when you should add it, taking into account the opponent's perspective. This is because those opponents of tenets proponents of tenets have already asserted the essential existence of those objects. In any other case whatsoever, where when the advocates do conventionally posit the object, if you fail to add qualification when refuting it, then the fallacies of you adduce will equally apply to your own critic, and hence it will not only it will be only a sham of refutation. Thus, it must be added. Moreover, as explained earlier, neither raising consciousness, which analyzes whether something exists intrinsically or conventionally, a valid cognition can contradict what the Madhyamakas posit conventionally. For if either did, it would be utterly untenable to make the decision that we do not conventionally assert things such as a divine creator, and yet we do assert forms, sounds, and such. Hence, there would be no way to make presentations of the mundane or supramundane such as this is the path, that is the path, not the path, or this is tenet, this tenet is correct, that tenet is not correct, that is not correct. Consequently, the distinguishing feature that all the presentations of cycling existence and nirvana are tenable within the emptiness of intrinsic existence would be impossible. To a skillful philosopher, it is ridiculous to claim that something is refuted even though such valid cognitions do not contradict it. Therefore, when stating that you refute those phenomena such as forms, you should be sure to add qualifying phrase. Chandrakirti's commentary on 400 stanzas and commentary on 60 stanzas of reasoning very often add a qualifying phrase when refuting the object to be negated. Such phrases frequently appear in Nagarjuna's fundamental treatise, in Buddhapala's commentary on the fundamental treatise, and in Chandrakirti's clear words and commentary on the middle way, along with his explanation of the middle way commentary. Thus, those authors regard their repetition of qualifying phrases as excessive verbiage. They thought that the significance of their having added them at certain points would make it easily understood, even when they did not. You should add it even where they did not, because there is not the slightest difference between the places where they did add it and the places where they did not. Furthermore, they frequently add the qualification of analysis, saying, when analyzed, it does not exist. As explained above, this means that hence, you should realize that this makes the same point. It does not exist essentially or intrinsically, for it is, as Chandrakirti's commentary says. And next topic, whether to add the qualification ultimate to the object of negation. It is quite unreasonable to claim that adding the qualification ultimate to the object of negation is the procedure only in the Sarvadvitaka Madhyamaka. Chandrakirti's explanation of the middle way commentary cites the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra in Venerable Subhuti. It is said, Venerable Subhuti, is it that there is no attainment or no clear knowledge? Subhuti answered, Venerable Shariputra, there is attainment, there is also clear knowledge, but not in a dualistic sense. Venerable Shariputra, attainment and clear knowledge exist in worldly conventions. Also, stream enters, once returners, never returners, arahats, pratyeka buddhas, and bodhisattvas exist in worldly conventions. Ultimately, however, there is no attainment and there is no clear knowledge. Chandrakirti's explanation of the middle way commentary says that you should follow this statement. Do you claim that this is a Sarvatantrika Sutra? It is evident that there are a great many such cases where definitive sutras add the qualification ultimate. So also Nagarjuna 70 stanzas on Tenet says, through the force of worldly convention and not through the force of reality, the Buddha spoke of duration, production, cessation, of existence and non-existence, and what is low, moderate, or supreme. Also Nagarjuna Precious Garland says, it is said that both the self and that which belongs to the self exist, they do not exist in the ultimate sense? Also, how can something be true when the seed that produces is false? And also, similarly, production and disintegration appear in this illusory world, but ultimately there is no production and no disintegration. Thus, such texts often make statements in this in which they attach ultimately, truly, or in reality to the negation. Even when they do not add those, they very frequently add a qualification that something does not exist essentially, does not exist intrinsically, or does not exist by way of its intrinsic character. Thus, he says that page 219. In brief, if you in no way accept the addition of qualification ultimately to the negation, then you will have no way to distinguish the true truths, and you will be not be able to say ultimately it is such and such, conventionally it is such and such. There is no explanation of such a madhyamaka way anyway, so it is simply a wrong idea. Chandrakirti's clear words refutes addition of qualification ultimately to the negation of the context of in the context of refuting production from self, not in the context of refuting mere production. This is very clear in that commentary. Also, as Chandrakirti's explanation of the middle way commentary says, so these are the words with reference to turning back the criticism of the what is called the logical consequences. Consequently, we do not distinguish Savatantrika Madhyamaka and Prasangika Madhyamaka by way of whether they add the qualification ultimately to the negation. Instead, they differ in whether they refute essential or intrinsic existence conventionally. Hence, when refuting the essential or intrinsic existence of internal and external phenomena, Prasangika say that it is unnecessary to add on new qualifications such as ultimately in reality. So with regard to this term ultimate, this can be either used in relation to the object of negation or to the objects. So it can also be applied to the subjective mind. So Solness was commenting on this passage on page 220, which the paragraph, what is the meaning of does not exist ultimately? Here, object means something knowable and so forth. Commenting on this, his blaze of reasoning says, regarding the term ultimate, it is an object because it is something to be known. It is synonymous with something to be examined and something to be understood. Highest in, is a term that means supreme. So, on page 221, in the reply section, so to the calm, in what way is it that things do not exist intrinsically? Chandrakirti says, in reality, the term reality refers to the status of things, just as they are, something that is known by an inference based on facts. This is the same as saying that things are empty when you analyze them, just as they are. This explains the phrase, in reality, ultimate, and so forth. Yeah.
Rangshin
In other way, terms such as reality may refer only to knowledge of reality because that is what it observes. Knowledge of reality, not conventional knowledge, provides the understanding that allows us to say that things do not exist intrinsically. Both Bhava Viveka's lamp for Nagarjuna's fundamental literatures and his blaze of reasons often add qualifications such as in reality to the absence of intrinsic existence. In particular, the lamp for the fundamental commenting on the 15th chapter says, objection, if things have no essence, how can they be things? If they are things, then they are not without essence. Thus, you have the fallacy of mistakenly denying those objects with the very words within your thesis. The objection is that within this thesis, things do not have essence. Bhava Viveka contradicts his own words. In that same text, he replies, we did not claim that things ultimately have essence and then advance the thesis of essencelessness. Therefore, we do not, on that account, mistakenly deny the object of our thesis. Thus, since this is not a case where the meaning of its reason is not established, we have no fault. He holds that he does not mistakenly deny things due to his assertion that things lack essence ultimately. So it is clear that he asserts that it would be mistaken a denial to say that they lack essence, that is, do not essentially exist conventionally. That same text also says, ultimately, internal things lack essence because they are produced and also because this distinctive statement of their being produced indicates that they are contingent upon the dependent. For example, they are like human beings, etc., that a conjurer has emanated. So, end of 223. So, this shows the difference between whether the philosophers assert, even conventionally, self-characterized phenomena or not. So, continue. So, having identified the object of negation, whether to carry out that refutation with the Savatantrika procedure or with the Prasangika procedure? Should you refute an object of negation with the Savatantrika procedure or Prasangika procedure? This is two parts, the meaning of Savatantrika and Prasangika, which system to follow so as to develop the right philosophical view in your mind stream. Regarding the first, it is not clear that the commentary of Master Buddha Balita sets up a Prasangika system, distinguishing Prasangika from Savatantrika. Nonetheless, consider his commentary on the opening lines of the fundamental treatise. There is no sense in which anything has ever been produced, either from itself, from something else, from both, or without a cause. Here, he negates the four types of production by pointing out the faults of other systems. The Master Bhava Viveka refutes him, claiming that the Buddha Palita's arguments have no power to establish his own position or to repudiate the positions of others. Now, Master Chandrakirti extensively comments on why Buddha Palita's own system does not suffer from such faults, and in so doing, he states that Madhyamaka should employ reductio ad absurdum arguments and not autonomous the arguments, as so the valid cognition from the Savatantrikas using the autonomous reasoning is because of asserting that sensory perceptions, conceptions are not wrong, not faulty in respect to their perceiving or having the appearance of self-defined characteristic or self-defined objects. Does not suffer the forms of the Madhyamaka, not autonomous arguments, as their method of for instilling the Madhyamaka view in others. So this master was a great
Jubilee,
So regarding Jaya Ananda, he was a great scholar. So the question, if you consider the first misinterpretation, so this is called the reasoning for others, for the, which are renounced to others. So if you consider reductive absurdum arguments to be a logistic reasoning, syllogistic reasoning, then does valid cognition establish it? If so, then it would be established for both parties. So how can you say that this is what the other party asserts? If not, then since it is would be inappropriate for the other party to assert what is not established, how can you say that it is what the other party asserts? Reply, some might answer, whatever valid cognition establishes is established for both sides, but that is precisely what we do not know. When one party possesses something as a probative reason, even though a valid cognition may establish it for the one who posits the syllogism, how can that person be certain that valid cognition establishes it for the other party? After all, the particulars of another person's mind are objects of neither perception nor inference. And how can you be certain that valid cognition establishes it even for yourself? For it is possible that you could be deceived inasmuch as you have been under the influence of error for an exceedingly long time. Therefore, I accept the nature of things on the strength of both proponent and opponent accepting such as valid. Hence, I refute the positions of others in terms of this their assertion, their own assertions. The proponent of any syllogism does not know whether the opponents have established the reason for themselves by means of a valid cognition. This is because neither of the two types of valid cognition the sensory valid cognition based on reason gave the proponents access to that opponent's thinking. You cannot be certain that valid cognition established the reason even for yourself, for even when you determine that you have established it by valid cognition, it is possible that you can be deceived. Therefore, since there is no validly established reasons, the debate is founded on what the parties accept as valid. Hence, it is proper to refute opponents in terms of what they accept, even though valid cognition does not establish anything for either party. This is how he explains it. And again, this same explanation of Chandrakirti's commentary on the Middle Way continues. So, after the quotations, if valid cognition establishes privations, such as the presence of fire, wherever there is smoke or the impermanence of all that is produced, then autonomous arguments would be acceptable, but they do not. If valid cognition establishes privations, then privation concerning the existence of fire, wherever there is smoke and impermanence, wherever there is production, would have to be established in all places and times. However, since perception and inference establish those variations only in relation to specific domains, such as kitchen and pots, the scope of those variations is establish even the privations. This is what Jayananda says. Evidently, he believes that if a proof uses a reason for which valid cognition has established the three criteria, then it is an autonomous argument. If a proof is made just on the basis of the parties accepting the fulfillment of the three criteria, then it is a reductio argument. Next topic, the second misinterpretation. Some translators, students of the scholar Jayananda argue that as follows, Madhyamakas have no thesis of their own. They only refute what others believe. Since the elements of a syllogism such as the subject are not agreed upon, that is, accepted by both parties, autonomous arguments are not tenable. and so forth. Page 229. Well then, do you or do you not believe that such refutations of what the opponents accept? If you do, then that in itself constitutes your thesis, and there would be an autonomous reason providing that position. If you do not, it is pointless for you to give arguments that refute what the other party accepts. Reply by the followers of Jnananda, when you analyze the ultimate, if you accept a predicate such as lacks intrinsic existence or is not produced, then you have to accept autonomous thesis and reasons. However, since we do not accept such predicates, we have no fault. If simply believing something means that you have a thesis, then everyone would have thesis about everything. That is how the followers of Jnananda explain their position. Evidently, they believe that even though they have nothing to prove from their own side, they can merely refute others' position, that even though they have beliefs, they have no thesis, and that they have no position of their own avoiding these thesis, such as absence of intrinsic existence when analyzing the ultimate. Apparently, they are considered as Savatantrikas, those who do not believe that there is nothing at all that can be asserted, and who, therefore, when analyzing the ultimate, assert the predicate lacks intrinsic nature and establish that they that as their own position. Those who do not assert such predicates but engage only in the refutation of what others accept, they consider Prasangikas. The third misinterpretation, according to those who today consider themselves Prasangika Madhyamakas, there is nothing to accept even conventionally in one's own system, neither as regards the ultimate nor as regards the conventionally. If you have such a thesis, then you have to accept the examples and reasons that prove it, and in that case, you are a Savatantrika. Therefore, Prasangikas have no system of their own at all. For Nagarjuna's repetition of objection, he says, if I had any thesis, then I would suffer from that fault. But as I have noticed, I alone am without fault. If sensory perception and so forth could actually perceive something, then there would be something to prove or to refute. But as they do not, I cannot be faulted. As Nagarjuna's 60 stanzas of reasoning says, Mahatmas have no positions. They have no arguments. How can those who have no positions themselves have positions vis-a-vis others? Also, Aryadevas, 400 stanzas, says, no matter how long you try, you can never rebut those who have no positions. So, some earlier Madhyamakas, the fourth misinterpretation, some earlier Madhyamakas, Tibetan scholars who follow the Chandrakirti, argue as follows. So, these are Patsap and his followers. We completely reject these systems that claim that Madhyamakas have no position of their own and no valid cognition to establish them. Our own system is as follows. We refute both the perceptual and inferential valid cognition based on real fact of those who put forward presentations of valid cognition and objects it cognizes in terms of the intrinsic character that can withstand rational analysis. Accepting conventionally without analysis and without cognition and cognized. So these are much clearer in the lecture in Yingbo, Essence of True Eloquence. And next, refuting those positions, refuting the first misinterpretation. In the system of Jayananda's explanation of valid commentary on the middle way, valid cognition does not establish the reason and the pervasion. Jayananda claims that valid cognition does not establish the reason, but his justification is deficient for the following reasons. And one, even in the system that holds that both proponent and opponent must have previously established the reason with valid cognition, something does not cease to be considered a reason simply because the opponent is not certain that the reason is established for the opponent. Hence, Jayananda's rationale does not vitiate against the necessity of the opponents establishing the reason by means of a valid cognition. Number two, if you claim that you do not know whether a reason is established for an opponent, because you do not know the mind of the opponent, then it follows that you cannot even be certain that the other party has accepted a particular point. Therefore, it would be impossible to refute opponents in terms of what they accept, etc. Why? Even if you have perceptual certainty about the opponent's words when they say, this is what we accept following your logic, you would not have certain knowledge that they actually accept what they have stated, because you do not know the minds of the other beings. The justification that Jayananda gives for why valid cognition does not establish the pervasion is also adequate. The kitchen is the object based upon which you understand the pervasion. In the kitchen, where there is smoke, there is fire. The thing understood with respect to that basis is the bare pervasion. When there is smoke, there is fire. It is certainly not that you are to apprehend the pervasion where there is kitchen smoke, where there is kitchen fire. Hence, what could it be? How could it be that you apprehend the pervasion limited to a particular time and place? Or else, if the pervasion were limited in that way, since kitchen would not work as the basis for ascertaining such a limited pervasion, you would have to adduce some other basis in relation to which ascertainment of the limited pervasion is needed. For example, impermanence, a predicated quality that is ascertained with respect to sound, must apply to both sound and pots. A form of impermanence that is sounds alone cannot be posited as the predicated quality. This same line of reasoning demonstrates that it is incorrect to hold that the inference at establishing pervasion is not a valid cognition. He also claims that only the proponents and opponents' acceptance of the pervasion establishes inasmuch as valid cognition does not establish it. That this also is incorrect. Why? If you treat the mere acceptance of a position as justification for it, then you cannot refute the opponent, for the opponent's assertion of a point would establish it. Neither side has any valid cognition that can refute it. Question? But what if you were to distinguish between different types of acceptance, wherein one type could and the other could not establish the reason, pervasion, etc.? Reply. If you justify just such a distinction by the mere fact that it has been asserted, then your argument resembles that you are what you are trying to prove, and you have not advanced your position. If, however, you make the distinction on the basis of whether there is a valid cognition of to back up an assertion, then you have strayed from your belief that there are no valid cognitions. Refuting the second misinterpretation, you hold that avoiding autonomous thesis means that when analyzing reality, you do not assert the thesis that there is no intrinsic nature. But in not accepting that thesis, is it because the thesis is not established by the reason, knowledge analyzing whether there is intrinsic nature? Or in not accepting that thesis, do you adduce the reason that this is an occasion in which reality is being analyzed? Which do you hold? In the first case, if reasoned knowledge does not establish the referent of the thesis, the lack of intrinsic nature, then reasoned knowledge could also not refute the referent of the thesis intrinsic nature exists for similar reasons, and it is utterly incorrect for you to think that the referent of the thesis intrinsic nature exists is not refuted when reality is being analyzed for the following reasons. One, you claimed previously that, that reasoned analysis refutes the other system. Number two, non-analytical knowledge cannot refute other system. Otherwise, if analysis did not refute this, the thesis intrinsic nature exists, then why would you have to specify we accept no thesis in our own system? For in that case, you would not even accept reductio arguments that refutes the other system. When you use a reductio arguments to eliminate the attendance of other party, then the refutation of the existence of intrinsic nature should itself establish the absence of intrinsic nature. I made this point above in regard to previously cited passages from the refutation of objections and its commentary. There is no third alternative. Were this not the case, someone might claim just the opposite of your position, saying, I'm establishing the absence of intrinsic nature, I'm not refuting the existence of intrinsic nature. What response could you give? If you think that affirming the absence of intrinsic nature must, without a doubt, negate intrinsic nature, then it should also be the case that negating the existence of intrinsic nature must, without a doubt, similarly affirm the absence of intrinsic nature. If you think that theses such as the absence of intrinsic nature are improper because that is the indication in which reality is being analyzed, do you give your justification for this now? You may suppose that one cannot accept such beliefs because something that exists when reality is being analyzed must ultimately exist, but this conclusion is incorrect. If you reject the very occasion during which reality is being analyzed, then you will have to accept the impossibility of a time period during which a Madhyamaka analyzes things with reason. But if you admit to such an occasion, then you definitely must also accept the existence of an analyzer. The analyzer, the analyzing reason, the basis of the analysis, the opponent with whom you are analyzing, etc. Hence, why is it necessary for everything that exists at that time to exist ultimately? So His Holiness wishes to stop here. Refuting of the third interpretation, misinterpretation. Page 237. Dogun nam da shin la je bar shu. Namrim Prayer, at the end of this third volume, on page 368, verse beginning by accumulating through long effort the two collections as vast as the sky may become the chief of the conquerors, guides of all beings whose minds are blinded by ignorance. Also, in all lives, until I reach that point, may Manjukosha look after me with loving kindness. After I find the supreme path complete in the stages of teaching, by accomplishing it, may I please the conquerors. By skillful in means, inspired by strong loving kindness, may the vital points of the path that I precisely know clear away the mental darkness of beings. May I then uphold the conqueror's teachings for a long time in regions where the supreme precious teaching has not spread, or where it has spread but then declined. May I illumine that treasure of happiness and benefit with a mind deeply moved by that great compassion. May this treatise on the stages of the to enlightenment, well-founded on the wondrous deeds of the conquerors and their children, bring glory to the minds of those who want to be free and long preserve the conquerors' achievements. As for all who provide conditions that support integration of the good path and clear away conditions that inhibit that integration, whether they are humans or not, may they never be separated in all their lifetimes from the pure path praised by the conquerors. When I strive to properly achieve the supreme vehicle through the 10 deeds of the teaching, may I be accompanied always by those who have power, and may an ocean of good fortune pervade all directions. Of truth. Magnificent master of an ocean of limitless good qualities, those Tathagatas of the three times, your children and disciples, looking upon this destitute migrators like your own three child, please pay attention to my true words of sorrow. Expand the doctrine of the completely perfect capable one, which removes the suffering of sacrifice and solitary peace for abundant extensive welfare and happiness in Jambudvipa, increase the 10 kinds of dharma contacts of all those learned and accomplished holders of the doctrine by pacifying all the unbearable dangers of sickness, weapons, and famine, cause those migrators totally compelled by intolerable strong karma, stricken by the torture of sufferings without respite, to cover their breath in an ocean of happiness and joy, particularly for all the migratory beings in the religious snowland, oppressed with evil actions by the barbarian hordes from the black side. Devoid of love, may your power of compassion arise and quickly stop the flow of blood and tears. May all the unruly groups of people, maddened by the demon of afflicted emotions about who, by their rough behavior, ruin themselves and others, fully obtain the eye which sees that object of compassion and obtain magnificent love, kindness, and affection. The wish that since long dwells in our hearts is the glorious, complete freedom for the entire Tibetan country. Bestow soon the fortune to enjoy the celebration of spontaneous religious and secular harmony. All people who completely give up their cherished body, life, possessions, and endure hundreds of hardships for the sake of the doctrine its holders, their country, and their compatriots, may they be guarded by the compassion of the protector of Tathāgata. In short, may the good fruit of extensive prayer to fully protect the land of snows made by the powerful protector Chandra Sikh in the presence of the Buddhas and their children appear soon here and now by the dependence of the profound suchness of appearance and emptiness, by the power of the three sublimes, compassion, and the force of the true words. May the power of the truth, infallible action and results, may our prayer of truth be fulfilled soon and without obstacle. Nuche di dema sa. Nosan gen dema. Nosan gen dema de yan na sa gaza. Sons. Tren de yan sons, kono jesha. So...